Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Okay, so we'd like to welcome to the podcast our next guest, Sarah Payton. Sarah is the author of the best-selling book, Your Resonant Self, which I've really enjoyed, Sarah. And Sarah is also a neuroscience educator and a non-violent communication instructor. Now, I'd encountered Sarah on Twitter where I'd noticed your neuroscience-focused blog posts. And what I really liked about them was the way that you made neuroscience of trauma very accessible for people who don't have a background in biology. And I suppose with all that jargon, it can be quite difficult to get your head around. And you'd gone to quite some lengths to make sure that people could understand what you were talking about. And I'd really encourage people to check out Sarah's website, which is sarahpayton.com, as you give loads of really useful resources away for free on that website, Sarah, which is really nice. So really like to welcome you along today, and thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Sarah, I'm a bit struggling to find the right word, a bit of an ignoramus in the field that you're an expert in, so I'm looking forward to learning quite a lot from you today. So we know from a previous conversation you've spent years running groups in prison for women, which we'll come to in a minute, but I wondered if you could say something about your journey which has brought you up to this point in life.
Absolutely. The main thing that happened to me, as well as, of course, my own traumatic childhood and the healing journey from that, was that my husband and I ended up sort of being adopted by and adopting a young man who had been houseless. And he came into our family when he was 15, and we all loved each other very much. And he was, but he was coming from a background of very intense trauma. And we eventually lost him to addiction in connection with the trauma. He died when he was 33. So we had him for 18 years, really, very much as a member of our family. But it changed us. And it brought us deeply into relationship with both the effort to heal trauma and with, of course, the tragedies and losses that are a part of trauma, which are so much a part of what happens for folks who are in the prison populations all over the world.
Well, that's a very powerful narrative, Sarah, and it sounds as if things had been very tough for you at that time. So what made you think it would be a good idea to go into prisons and start teaching people about neuroscience?
I actually was wondering about teaching nonviolent communication in the prisons. It was in the very beginning of my nonviolent communication teaching journey, and there was a woman who was going into this particular prison that I go into, which is south of Portland, Oregon, and she just invited me to go. It was sort of by chance, and so I went with her, and we did straight nonviolent communication, and I so wanted to add the neuroscience. And eventually I persisted, and I kept working there as a volunteer and brought the neuroscience in. And the women were so excited about learning about their own brains and about making sense of their life's journey and how trauma impacts us and how it fractures brains. And so many of the women, for example, there had seizures. And we know that seizures are an after effect of sexual abuse. It's right there in the literature. And they were like, oh my God, thank you. I mean, there's something sort of an immense and difficult about learning about the effects of trauma, but there's also something where it releases stigma and lets us know that there's not something inherently wrong with us, but in fact, we've been had some maladaptive strategies to very difficult things that happened for our childhood brains.
I didn't know that connection with seizures and the history of abuse. And why does that happen?
It impacts, sexual abuse leaves traces in the cerebellum, which appears to disrupt the electrical pulses of the brain. There's not research that shows this is what happens and this is why. There's rather research that shows that sexual abuse affects the cerebellum, and then speculation that that is why the seizures happen.
That's fascinating. And you also mentioned about the nonviolent communication, and I just wonder if for the benefit of listeners who might not be very familiar with that approach, I wondered if you could say something briefly about that.
Yes, in nonviolent communication, we start to think about the way that we're using words, because we can use our fists and our feet to hurt people, but we can also use our words to hurt people. And it's much more common, actually, than hurting people physically. And it actually has more profound effects on brains. It's actually worse than, it creates more dissociation than anything else except for sexual abuse with a parent. All of the other forms of abuse do not create so much dissociation. We are more violent with our words than we are with anything else. And it just sort of slips past people's radars. And if we're accustomed to it from childhood, we don't even know that either we're being violent with our words or that we're receiving violence with our words. Although we can, again, track changes in the gray matter and the white matter that's connected with the verbal areas when there's verbal abuse. And we can also track rates of dissociation and see that people are sort of adopt a habit of dissociation in the presence of verbal abuse.
Do you think that's so much more difficult to process because of the kind of grey ground that it occupies? It's kind of like there's a threshold, isn't there, that if somebody physically strikes you, everyone knows that that's unacceptable. But then there's this kind of like land in the middle, isn't there, where it might be a little bit blurred and a bit uncertain.
Yes. And verbal abuse can include name calling and stuff that's, you know, fairly clear, like I'm being called an idiot. Okay, that's probably not a good thing. But it can also include being told experiencing, and this is so characteristic also for many of the women that I've worked with in the prison, that they were told by their partners that they were too sensitive, that they were crazy, that a lot of sort of an idea that women are emotionally unstable, and then the abuse pushing them into an idea of emotional instability. You're too sensitive, you're getting things wrong, you made a mistake. All of this is also verbal abuse, roughly under that header of gaslighting, which I think in the UK actually is in the criminal code, it's not allowed, which makes me very happy. I think it's the only country in the world that's integrated that into the criminal code. So because it's, of course, it's hugely important. There's so much need for respect and care and warmth with each other, with our language.
Thank you. Yes. Earlier on, you'd mentioned stigma in the course of your work. And I wonder whether you found that stigma was something that the people you're working with knew about and thought about and talked about, or whether it was something that emerged during the course of the work you were doing.
I think more people will talk about shame. They'll use the word shame, and they will talk about shame. They won't talk about it right away. It'll take a couple of years usually before they start to really think about and realize shame. The first thing that they're interested is anger, because that's what got so many of them into legal trouble, is reactivities in some way, or being at the mercy of reactivity of partners also. So they're very, very interested, starting out with anger, and then become more interested in other things like shame and sorrow and being able to name fear as their journey progresses.
So they were able to identify their own anger from quite an early point, were they?
Yes, I think anger in an environment where there are a lot of adverse childhood experiences, anger is the most likely thing to make you safe. Not always. Sometimes dissociation makes you safer. But if you can find that sort of life energy and fight back, both in families and on the street, then you have at least you have some kind of protection in a world where there's very little protection.
Yeah, you often see that, I think, you really see it in a male population, that being angry enables all of us, doesn't it, to feel very powerful, and that even if you're angry at times verges into being out of control, there's still a powerfulness about it, and that can seem more preferable to people than tolerating some of the other feelings that make you feel really vulnerable, like the sadness, the fear, the shame, all of those sorts of things.
Plus, if you've been beaten for displaying those things, you get very clear messages from your society and your home that, for example, it's just not okay to show that you're scared, or it's not okay to show that you're sad.
So the kind of intervention that you've been talking about, Sarah, it sounds a bit unusual to me. We see a lot about prisons and for men in America on our TV here. There never stops. But we see much less about women's prisons. Is the kind of work you're doing fairly common or rather unique?
Well, I know that at the facility that I work at, there was once a call for all the volunteers to come, and there were 2,000 or 3,000 volunteers who came. So I think there's, in the United States at any rate, there's such a movement connected with churches and 12-step groups for prison outreach that there's quite a lot of outreach at most prisons in America, just from local churches and 12-step groups. Quilters also. The quilters go in and make beautiful quilts with the women who are inside at the prison that I work at as well.
I've always found it fascinating, actually, the way needlecraft emerges in prisons. I was quite shocked when I went to work at Whitemore and found kind of like men in their 50s and 60s doing cross-stitching. And rightly or wrongly, that just really surprised me that this was a big hobby.
And that can be done in small spaces with soft materials, I think. Yeah.
But in terms of kind of like going in and talking about the science with people in there, is that the kind of thing that's common in American prisons?
No, because there aren't that many neuroscience educators in the world. So I think it's that part is fairly unique. I've met many other people who bring nonviolent communication into the prison in their local area in the United States, but very few who bring in either the neuroscience, which is so freeing for people to learn. To learn that we are more reactive, that we have fewer neurons that keep us back from our anger if we've lived through trauma, and that we need to grow them and nourish them like a kind of permaculture garden of neurons is a very important concept. And then I also have begun over these last years going in a slightly different capacity, where I bring constellation work into the prison, and I bring in a group of volunteers, 8 or 10 volunteers, and we get a room of 30 or 40 women, and we do family constellations and start to look at not only the patterns of violence in this generation, but what have the patterns of violence been in past generations. So one woman I was working with was a murderer. In her mother's generation there had been murders, and in her grandparents' generation there had been murder. So it's also, you know, starting to look at family culture and at the impact of family trauma, past generations of trauma, that also, it's another way of expanding the lens. I think I'm always so interested in what happens for people when the lens of how they look at themselves is expanded. And that happens both with the neuroscience and with this multi-generational view of families.
I guess some people might use that as evidence of there being a genetic, some, you know, genetic contribution to murdering. And I wondered, so for instance, with that particular, in those kind of circumstances, how you encourage people to think about things with a little bit more flexibility about events and life events.
There's a wonderful American fellow who who's done research into psychopaths. And what he's done is he went around the United States and he took fMRIs of folks who were murderers and who had been diagnosed as being psychopaths. And he found that sure enough, there was a pattern in their brain that appeared to be genetic, that was a kind of a darkness of an area that holds a moral compass in the brain called the orbital frontal cortex. And so he was very excited about his work because he thought that it showed this genetic transmission. And then he was talking to his grandmother at Thanksgiving and he was so excited. And he said, and this is what I'm discovering. And she said, oh, there are murderers in our family. I wonder what our brains are like. And he put himself in the MRI and he also had that area dark. But he himself was not a psychopath or a murderer because he had had a very wonderful family. And so part of what we're learning over and over again is that we can't say something is just nature. We have to look at both nature and nurture. That if we've got this predisposition to have the right orbital frontal cortex be dark, then we also need to look at childhood trauma. Because if there's childhood trauma and the dark right orbital frontal cortex, we're in trouble. Or society is in trouble. And if we have a sweet family and a dark orbital frontal cortex, we're going to be fine. We're going to like high-risk sports, ex-sports, but we're not going to be having problems with killing people. So it's quite an interesting thing that we're moving into a kind of a integrative view of both nature and nurture, that there's no way to just say, okay, these folks are bad and wrong, and they have bad genes and we should just lock them up and close the door and throw away the key. Instead, we really need to be thinking about trauma and what heals brains and what changes people and what awakens the other parts of the brain that compensate for difficult childhood events. And, yeah.
And it sounds like the women that participated that were on the receiving end of the group, sounds like they enjoyed what you were teaching them, and there was a hunger for that.
Well, there was. I mean, I think about, you know, there's an Australian show, I think, and called something that begins with W. And then there's Orange is the New Black, you know, thinking about women in prison and mass media. And I watched both of those shows, and in both of those shows, I was, you know, comparing it with my experience of going in. And I was like, where is the longing for spiritual awakening? Because that's what I run into the most, is like the women are like, please help me. If you've got something that can help me see myself differently and experience my life and my addiction differently, please help me. And there was none of that in no hunger for something better, really, in the TV shows. So I really felt like it was selling our humanity short, those shows. And that really what I run into more than anything else, even in the women who can't bear the emotionality of the process and leave the room, always some that are like, oh my God, and they walk out. but even in those women, you can feel their hunger and their longing, like, please reach me with something. And, and I think that's such an important thing to remember.
What is it, you know, for those women that don't manage to stay and tolerate it, what is it about that contributes to that?
Well, it's too many emotions that are not anger. I think it's the appearance of sadness, the appearance of vulnerability, the truth telling. It can be so vulnerable in the prison that I work in, it's people make themselves so vulnerable. If anyone knows anything about them, if they can keep their stories closed and to themselves, they're much safer in the general population. Whatever it is that they do gets whatever anybody knows about you becomes leveraged there. So it takes a certain amount of like the overriding longing for something better to override the basic safety information of like, do not disclose.
And I wondered, Sarah, how was what you were doing received by the institution? You know, was the governor of the prison happy to have you in there teaching this course? And would that be common again?
with 2,000 volunteers in a prison that serves 1,000 women, I don't think that that there's much of a bump, you know. I think there's a bump in the prison population. Women who have worked with me will come back, and that is the most helpful thing. They'll come back and they'll speak at the beginning, at the opening circle, and they'll say, "You're going to think this is too weird. You're going to want to walk out. Don't do it. Stay here. Share your story. Let this happen. This really helps." So the women themselves have, we have one woman in there who brings in 20 people. She'll just usher them in, young women. She's in her 40s or 50s, and she'll just like usher in this big group, and she'll sit them down and she'll say, "You're going to want to leave, but don't go. Sarah has changed my life." And not that I have, but certainly constellation work and neuroscience and warmth and getting to look at the big picture of our lives, you know, really does change lives. So the women themselves carry that institutional knowledge about what kind of benefit this can bring. But there are so many volunteers that I don't think that I register much at all. Although I did one time get a plaque that was Volunteer of the Quarter for in 1998 or something. That was wonderful. So,
well, I think you highlight something really important though, in terms of having people with lived experience who've gone through the program be able to talk about. And David's very experienced in terms of working in therapeutic communities, which I think really harness that ability, don't they, David?
Yeah, I think so. I was just thinking, as you're talking there, I mean, you're talking in a terribly interesting manner about the work that you do and how you engage the people you work with. And I was thinking, of course, what we're talking about here is you're encouraging people to generate meaning in their own understanding and meaning for their own lives. And you've got these tools that you use. But underlying all of it is the kind of relationship that you build up with these people. And it sounds as if many of them really engage with you, and that becomes a very important part of the work.
Yes.
And of course, that's what therapeutic communities do. They focus upon developing a culture which supports the kind of engagement you're talking about, I think. Yeah. Is that about right?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And I think the, you know, when you've got those people who already have, like you said, for some people at the start, it can seem a bit weird. And yet I think if you've got kind of like trusted members of the community there, you can kind of get away with presenting a bit more to people, can't you? I know that the unit where I work, that people would listen to the people who've been there longer in their experience, to hear them say, "Yeah, we found it odd at first as well," but it gives them, you get some, given some confidence imbued in you by this review of people who've already had it. So those relationships are so crucial, aren't they, in terms of being able to do really quite work that's quite emotionally challenging.
Yeah, it's so helpful. It changes the kind of baseline that you're starting at. If there's a more of a baseline of trust, that you don't have to work quite as hard in the beginning.
Mm. I wanted to just bring up your book for a moment, because I noticed within your book, which, as I said, I really enjoyed, and you include in your book at the end of kind of like during the chapters, there are meditations. So I've got the audio book version, and so being able to listen to those, but you also helpfully have those meditations on your website so that people can listen to the meditation, which can make it easier to focus. And one of the things that's really striking is that you're really thoughtful about some of the barriers that people encounter when they're trying to develop a mindfulness practice. And I wondered if you could say something about those barriers, because I don't think it's unusual for people to really, really struggle with mindfulness when they have a history of trauma.
Yes, and I myself had that experience of reading. I just kept reading about mindfulness meditation. I was like, this sounds like such a good idea. And I'd try it. And as soon as I sat down, the voices inside of my own head, it was just like they had razors. I mean, it was like lacerating Sarah to sit down to meditate. And I was like, well, this looks like it's a really good thing for other people, but it's not so good for me, I think. And then I went, I ran into, as I was studying the neuroscience, I went to a class that was being taught by the woman who wrote the foreword to the book now. But I ran into her in a university class. I just went back as an adult because I was interested in her and her teaching. And she did a very brief guided meditation where she said, your attention will go, invite your attention to stay with your breath. Your attention will go other places. That's what attention does. Gently and with warmth, acknowledge your attention for what it's trying to do for you and bring it back to your breath. And I was able to do a mindfulness meditation with her leading it for, it was some number of minutes. It was extraordinary for me. It was 2 minutes maybe. And then she said, the reason that it's so difficult for some people to do mindfulness meditation is because it takes us into the default mode network, which is the automatic voice of the brain, which is where trauma lives. And if we've had trauma when we were little, then the default mode network is very used to blaming us for the trauma. So as soon as we open the doors to the default mode network and step in with our mindfulness meditation, we're possibly stepping into a traumatized and self-blaming and intensely self-critical default mode network, which is what was happening for me. And so this knowledge really became a foundational starting point for all the meditations and for the book and for the research. It was so foundational, this idea of your critical inner voice makes sense. It comes from your trauma. And if you turn toward it with warmth and you let it make sense, I always like to say, it's not truth, it's trauma. When we're in relationship with the inner voice of the brain. So it's nice to, that would be, the women love meditations in the prison, the ones that I've worked with. But they also really like to have the information about the way that trauma impacts us.
Can I take you back a bit, Sarah? Because I realize that I've become engrossed in the kind of technical matters that you've been describing. And I still haven't got a very clear picture of what you actually do. So tell me, from the time you arrive, I don't know, in the morning or the afternoon, what happens? You go into the prison. Is this an open prison or a secure
prison? It's a medium and maximum security prison. There aren't very many maximum security prisoners in the state that I work in. So many of them are medium. Most of them are not murderers. Most of them are people who got involved with methamphetamines and started identity. Identity fraud is the very highest number of cases in the medium security prison. There was one woman I just adored. She said, I've been given IQ tests twice, she said, and I come out at 87. People think I am a moron, she said. But the reason that I'm in prison is because I went to, I picked up a magazine that told you how to change your cell phone to harvest people's credit card data. And so I harvested people's credit card data. She said, on my cell phone, I would just go through the mall and I would walk by everybody's purses and I would end up with all this credit card data. She said, I was arrested for having three different identities. They didn't know that I had 187. Like, these, there's something amazing and marvelous. This is one of my deep, of course, mournings, and the tragedy of prisons is that these women are totally gifted and have been battered by life to a point where they don't get to bring us their gifts. But just imagine if that person, you know, had been supported socially, where would we be if somebody that's 187 identities were, you know, pro-social, had been supported by life instead of battered by trauma? So there's always that sort of sense of shipwrecks, you know, and lost cargo in the work, and I long for the women to know that they are treasures.
Yes. Go on, Sarah.
Well, I lost your question in the.
I was just picking up your term of shipwrecks, which I think is a wonderful kind of mind picture, actually. But I was going to go back to
That was what you asked. What do I do?
Yeah. Well, my mind's still boggling at this quite large prison, 1,000, probably not so large in America, but quite large over here, medium and high security. I think the idea that 2,000, did you say, volunteers would be going into that would make most of our security departments have fits, but anyway.
So, I don't think they'll go in at once. No.
So you go in, and then do you convene a group? Do people sign up to come to your group, or what?
People sign up to come. It goes out in their newsletter to everyone, and then they sign up with the officers in their wards, and then they come in the morning. What I do these days is the constellation work. So I go in with 8 volunteers or so, and people who are experienced in constellation work. And are often learning it with me, learning to be facilitators themselves. And sometimes I bring international teachers. I've gotten to bring in an international constellations teacher from Ireland, and I've gotten to bring in an international constellations teacher from Russia into the prison and get to work with the women, and they get to experience something completely new and different. But we go in the morning, we have these volunteers, we sit in a circle, I do a brief introduction of constellation work, and I invite the women who've been in the circle before to speak so that they have this foundation of trust. And then I say, we do a little exercise so that people kind of get used to the idea of constellations, which is a funny and wonderful modality where different people represent different aspects of a question. So then someone will sit with me, someone from the prison population will sit with me, and I'll say, what would you most like help with? And people have all kinds of things they want help with. They need a better relationship with their child who's outside the prison. They want a better relationship with God. They want a better relationship. They'd like to have a partner. They want to come to terms with the impact of their crime. They want to pass a GED, a general equivalency diploma, which is a high school diploma. And all different kinds of questions. And they'll sit with me and I'll say, okay, let's say we have a question. There was a woman sat next to me and she said, I have no memory. I have no memory of my life after I was 8 years old. And I said, oh, what happened when you were 8? And she said, well, I was riding a bicycle with my very best friend in the world, and I turned left and he turned right and he turned in front of a truck and he was instantly killed. And so I said, okay, well, choose somebody for your 8-year-old self and choose somebody for that boy that was your best friend. And so those two came into the circle and she got to see them. Instead of what constellation work does for us is we don't have to be our life anymore. We get to look at it. So she got to look at herself there with her 8-year-old self and the boy who was lost. And we gradually, she walked closer and closer and closer to her 8-year-old self and began to have an immense compassion for that 8-year-old self. And we had the very good luck of being able to work with her again, because we only get to go in every 3 or 4 months. I mean, I haven't gotten to go in at all with COVID, of course, but we would get to go in every 3 or 4 months. And we went back, and the next time she came again to the group, and I said, how are you doing? She said, well, I remember my life, but it makes no sense. I remembered everything, and it's a huge jumble. And so we created then a timeline where she watched somebody else walk through her life, and we put it in order, and we brought out the different people who were very important at those different parts of her life, so that she got to have a chronology, which she hadn't had to have because the trauma disrupted the formation of self and the formation of memory. So it's like we get to, with constellation work, we get to almost work directly with the brain. And by letting people stand outside of their own brain and begin to make sense of their lives. Is that, David, how am I doing on giving you a sense of what happens?
You are, yes. I'm getting a frame of it now. I'm a bit surprised that you can only go in every several months. Could you not go in more often and continue
the work? I might be able to go in more often. The volunteers that I bring in with me are fly from all over the United States and all over the world to work with me. So I don't have them with me very often. And also I travel so much. Before COVID, I was on the road most of the year. So it would take a lot of planning to get in three or four times a year.
So it sounds like it's a sort of transformational event rather than an ongoing program.
Yes, I spent about 10 first years that I was working, I went in weekly because I was not traveling all over the world then. And then it was more of a class, 12-week classes. Every 12 weeks, start a new class.
How do you think your practice has evolved in recent years and particularly since you've been doing more work outside of prisons?
Well, one of the things that I would like to say about my work is that I had such a sense that the women that I worked with in the prison were an enormous part of the evolution of my work, that it was precisely by working with them that I became more and more clear both about how to hold the attention of a group, because that can be very challenging. People would often sign up for the weekly classes in order to see their friends. And so then they would sit in the back and be talking instead of listening to me. So I learned a hell of a lot about teaching from just, you know, week after week going in and trying to figure out how do you hold the attention of a group? And then just the goodwill and the good intention that they brought to the longing for something better deeply informs me. So both of those things have deeply informed my work as it's gone. I often feel that I'm drawing upon their commitment and their longing as I move into the world, because of course all of us have that commitment and longing, but it's less visible. It's less visible if we're not in prison. Yeah. But the development of my work has been going toward just a deeper and deeper integration of how do we use language? How do we use language nonviolently? What happens when we widen the lens with neuroscience? What happens when we widen the lens to look at the impact of history on our families?
You mentioned kind of flying around the world. What do you end up doing on those trips? Are you supporting other projects like this set up or doing something different?
No, usually I'm running workshops and presenting at conferences, mm-hmm. so that people who study constellations are coming to work with me, or people who want to receive constellations come, or people who want to learn about the language come to study with me for those days, sometimes up to a week. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm running certification programs where people are specifically learning about resonant healing, about this kind of convergence of both wide lens and a very specific and focused sense of how does language work? What takes us into space that's brain changing, and what kinds of language keep us out of brain changing space? So the more we tell each other what to do, the more we give each other advice, the less brain change happens. The more we stand beside each other and accompany each other so that there's resonant response to our experience in life, the more our brain changes. And the brain change that we support moves us towards secure attachment, moves us toward earned secure attachment, a very sweet way of using the brain, which decreases the flow of cortisol and increases the way that we kind of live off oxygen. Our red blood cells actually pick up more oxygen, and the bronchia of our lungs dilate when we have experiences of being accompanied rather than being told what to do. But it's specific learning. It's got some technical aspects, because we want to tell everybody what to do all the time.
But it does sound from your description that you establish a kind of feedback loop with the people you're working with. So they obviously hear you, and then you hear them, and that feeds into the discourse.
Yes. It's crucial for change to happen. There have to be two people involved.
The people who come to work alongside you, the ones who fly in from all over the United States in the days when planes flew,
yes.
What do you think they take away from you? What are the key things they learn from you, do you think?
Well, I want to say that they learn a lot from the women in prison. They learn an enormous amount about both the impact of trauma, about the ways that drug abuse, because drug abuse and addiction are absolutely rife. And I had one woman who came in from India and went in with us, and we were walking out of the prison, and she said to me, "I just didn't realize that American prisons were addiction treatment centers for the poor." And I said, "You are so right." Yeah. So so they learn about society, and they learn about themselves, and they learn compassion in terms of connection with the women. They also learn about the power of constellation work to change lives, because so often in personal growth and transformation circles, we're working with people who have been doing personal growth and transformation for years or decades, and they're already quite a long way along their journey. So there's something very startling about being able to do personal growth and transformation work that is so effective and neuroscience, relational neuroscience based, that lets them see the power and effectiveness of that work. So they're learning a lot from going into the prison with me. And from me, I think I'm sure that both of you have experienced this after your decades of experience, that there's a calmness that we have now that we didn't have in the beginning, going into institutions that, you know, we've worked through the big griefs and mournings and fears that come with working with these populations, and our bodies are calm. And whoever goes in with us learns that calmness from us, learns that sort of a peaceful way that's different from, certainly very different from what my body did when I would first go in.
Fascinating. So it sounds as if your practice really evolved from your own experience of recognizing what was helpful to you. Are there other ways that you can tell us about that you keep yourself nourished and positive and healthy, really?
Yes. I have my own beloved teachers. And researchers that I follow. I'm so interested in both the research that the neuroscience researchers do and how it changes them. We have a neuroscience researcher named Matthew Lieberman, who's quite well known in neuroscience circles and works at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. And I noticed that that the Russians tried to hire him away from UCLA at a very high rate of salary, lots of prestige, a huge lab. He was going to have 100 people, I don't remember, working for him in Russia. And he considered it seriously. And then he realized that he didn't want to do that to his family. He wanted to stay embedded in his community and in his family because it nourished him so much. And I felt like the work that he did really, you know, opened that place of self-connection for him. And so I'm so delighted by getting to be in the presence of neuroscience researchers who are doing relational neuroscience and watch how they're changed over time by their exposure to this beautiful material about how relationship really is key and essential in ways that we never even imagined. And I play the cello.
Ah, yes. That's what it is.
I'm very bad at it. I started when I was 50. I thought, okay, I'm 50 years old. I'm old enough to tell everybody that I will not play for them so that I can just be as bad as I am. I love cello music so much. So I found a very kind teacher and I take lessons. I take now lessons 3 times a week because of COVID. I take them online and I love it so much. Now I'm 58. It's been 8 years. I'm on book 2.
It is the best sound. Yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's good to be able to notice, isn't it, what's there that does kind of calm us, make us feel uplifted. And sometimes people don't spend enough time noticing the impact that something has, where it sounds like you're really attuned with what impact the cello does have on you, but also, you know, I heard that when you were talking about the learning as well, that kind of like the growth that you get from learning is uplifting and nourishing for you.
Yes, very nourishing.
Yeah, so thank you, Sarah. It was a really fascinating conversation, really, really enjoyable. I'm really grateful to you for getting up a bit earlier and giving us your time this morning with the time zone difference. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and I'm very grateful for you doing your mission in the world. Thank you for doing this podcast.
Thank you. I thought Sarah came across as a lovely woman who had clearly thought about this subject a lot, and she's got a very powerful emotional presence which connects with the people that she's working with. I was surprised that she only went in, you know, relatively infrequently, and that was what really led me to thinking that what she does is create the setting for an emotional event and enables the people she's working with to focus upon very important issues in their life and their upbringing. But I couldn't somehow see it as a long-term therapeutic process.
Yeah, I found that a really interesting conversation. I was quite gobsmacked by the notion of over 2,000 volunteers at some point going into a prison of that size, especially as prisons often seem so closed and impenetrable. So the idea that 2,000 people have managed to be coordinated to go in and contribute to something, I think, is pretty impressive. And then the second thing I took from the interview, which I enjoyed, was hearing about, you know, a greater emphasis upon giving people an understanding of the neuroscience of trauma and the impact that trauma has had on their biology. I think in the past there's been quite a lot of emphasis on helping people understand their diagnosis, and I think there's been a place for that in terms of helping people recognise that there's something identifiable, recognisable about how they present. But I think it's much more empowering to think about that as being a natural consequence of a traumatic episode, rather than, I think, when something's presented as a diagnosis, it appears to be as if there's something wrong with you. And it's great to hear more of these stories, accounts from people like Liz Mullinar and Sarah Payton about how people really benefit from having the knowledge about what's happened to them. So yeah, interesting conversation.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.